It was a wonderful letter that came out of this week of prayer and discernment, and it's extraordinary how far ahead of its time it was. And one of the things Clarence wrote was, what the poor need is not charity, but capital, not caseworkers, but co-workers. And what the rich need is a wise, honorable, and just way of divesting themselves of their overabundance.
This is Four People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Hello, friends. This is Bishop Rob Wright, and this is Four People, our podcast from the Diocese of Atlanta, where we talk about leadership and faith. Our special guest today is Jonathan Reckford. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Habitat for Humanity International, a global Christian housing organization that has helped more than 39 million people construct, rehabilitate, and preserve their homes. He has been the CEO of Habitat for Humanity since 2005, and he was recruited for that job while he was the pastor of Christ Presbyterian Church near Minneapolis, Minnesota. He's married to Ashley. They have three children, and he's an Atlantan. And so Google him, get to know him, and get to know his work. Jonathan, we're glad that you're here.
Thanks so much, Bishop Rob. It's great to be with you.
I'm full disclosure, I'm also a board member of Habitat for Humanity International, and proudly so, and love the work that you've been doing now for quite some time. And so a thumbnail sketch, tell us, what is the work of Habitat for Humanity?
Well, the vision for Habitat has always been a world where everyone has a decent place to live. Such an easy idea and so hard to actually make happen. And the core principles of Habitat have always been to the idea of partnership. So we build with, not for people. Our mission is to put God's love into action in a tangible way by bringing people together to build homes, communities, and hope. And the basic model, though we've expanded the breadth of our programming, was this idea of partnership housing, where families who couldn't get a traditional bank loan would put in sweat equity instead of a down payment, putting in hundreds of hours of helping build their home and their neighbors' homes, and taking training in financial management and home maintenance. And then they purchase the homes for an affordable mortgage. And as they make their payments, they're helping the next family have access to a loan to follow. And that model has been incredibly successful over time. And we've seen, even though these are technically subprime borrowers, extraordinary success rates. And I think for so many people who grew up in good housing, it's really hard to understand what it means not to have it. And maybe we're seeing more visibility now because the housing affordability is probably at its worst time in modern times. Right now. But Habitat serves in 70 countries worldwide, and we are do a mix of market development, which means we work to try to improve markets and lower barriers to allow people to improve their own housing conditions. We do our direct work in the community. And then a key part of our work is that's distinctive is we have volunteers engaged, not because that's necessarily the best construction strategy, but it's a way of actually changing hearts and minds and building community such that people are willing to change the environment and help us get closer to that vision that everybody's included.
Now, you're sort of a mixed bag yourself. I mean, you started off sort of on the corporate side of things, Goldman Sachs, Disney, Marriott, et cetera. You've got a graduate degree from Stanford in this regard. And then you've also been a pastor, right? So how did you get here? Tell us a little bit about the contours of that journey.
Well, I was blessed. I grew up in a college town, wonderful place to grow up, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and from a family that was deeply concerned with social issues. And a big figure in my life was my grandmother. Her name was Millicent Fenwick, and she was a ferocious fighter for human and civil rights from New Jersey, first as a volunteer and later as a member of Congress. And she, you know, as from my earliest days, would quote Micah 6:8 to me. He's shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to act justly and love mercy and walk humbly with your God. And then she'd ask me what I was going to do to be useful. And that was her view of sort of the good life, as we're supposed to be useful. And my mom had fought in the civil rights movement in the 60s when I was a baby, and so had grown up certainly with a sense of wanting to contribute or serve. It was I think God has a sense of humor. My career never really made any sense. I was a political science major. I was going to go to law school so I could go into politics like my grandmother. Realized I had no interest in being a lawyer. Naively talked my way into a job on Wall Street, despite having no business background or training, and suffered mightily for the hubris of saying I would learn finance classes and they would teach other people how to communicate. But in some ways, that was a low point for me. And I had really a couple of inflection points. The first one was I decided I really needed to regain perspective and was lucky enough to have a grant to spend a year in Korea back pre-internet, pre-email. And spent a year completely immersed doing coaching work with the Olympics and marketing work. And that was the year I got serious about faith. I'd grown up in a non-traditional but very devout Catholic family and had never walked away from faith, but nor had it been a central driving force or motivation. And that year, a dear friend, lifelong friend, gave me the amazing gift of his time and made a serious commitment, and then actually went to business school with the idea of learning in the business sector and then taking it to some kind of mission or ministry that mattered. And now I think there are all kinds of careers in the nonprofit world, but there weren't as many a million years ago when I was coming out of business school. And so had this very unexpected tour in the private sector, all of which, when I look back, has been incredibly valuable. And then the next big inflection point for me was I was president of a company called Musicland that is sadly gone, and Best Buy bought Musicland. And I stayed for a year to help with the merger, and then became clear they had put their person in. It was I could go into another role, but I couldn't stay in my current job. And I thought, you know, I've been in the private sector longer than I ever intended. Maybe now's the time to jump. And I went to India and had always been too busy. We had little kids. And so to go off on a short-term mission and went with a group of Presbyterian pastors to rural India, serving with the Bungi. And these among the outcasts or Dalits are the absolute bottom of the social caste system, where they are literally at that point in rural areas only allowed to hand clean latrines and clean up dead animals. And they're not allowed to live in community in the villages. And back when I was there, about half the kids were dying before their 13th birthday from the conditions. And I had always, I would say all the, you know, those latent justice issues just came pouring back up. And I really felt God just sort of shattered my heart around poverty issues. And I came back really on fire around that, turned down a couple of big business opportunities, saying, well, no, I've got my deal with God. And this is the slightly embarrassing part. Then all the doors closed. And the first time I'd really had to look for a job in a long time. And I was doing a lot of volunteer work. And if I'm honest, though, it's kind of painful. My deal was, God, I'll do anything you want as long as it meets my, you know, geographic, financial, ego gratification, social, and other long list of criteria.
Sure, sure. You're not the only one, friend.
It is, and so my avocation during that, you know, long season in the private sector had been helping grow churches. My business work had been growing businesses, and my volunteer work had been helping grow churches. So I had been very active in a wonderful Presbyterian church in Minneapolis. And yeah, I love that phrase. I'd actually grown up Catholic, then got married and was very active in the Episcopal Church. And Henry Blackaby had a wonderful quote. He's, if you're not sure what to do, look for where God is at work and join him there. And this church was just on fire in terms of the work they were doing around HIV and AIDS in Africa and local missions. And we really had a sense of pull. Now I want to do a key caveat. While I was doing all this job hunting, the church approached me and asked if I would be the administrative or executive pastor. So they did a very un-Presbyterian thing and put me in as the sort of administrative leader of the church to free up the senior pastor to be the spiritual leader of the church.
Yeah.
And so I was locally ordained, but not, but I'm very careful. I'm a fake pastor, but it is, and it was not anything I was looking to do. Everyone I trusted for career advice said, don't do this. This is a bad idea. And Ashley, my wife, and I had just a clear sense of this is what we're supposed to do at that moment. And I look back and it was exactly the thing I needed, though hopefully I was there to make a contribution. But I think that time in the church was the complement, along with that quiet waiting period, to get me ready for something like Habitat. So when I was then just serving in the church, not looking, Habitat came calling. And if I could have picked one job that would have checked everything on the list, including getting my Southern Georgian wife back to Georgia after 7 years in Minneapolis.
There you go.
It would have been Habitat. And I certainly never thought they would hire me, but I went and wrote a very passionate two-page letter saying, I think this is the kind of thing God has been preparing me for my whole career. And that was 2005. And it certainly hasn't been easy, but it has been by far the most joyful and inspiring time of my life.
It clearly, in my interactions with you, it clearly is a ministry for you. You know, it's, and of course, when I talk to people about discernment, I talk about finding that place where the most of you will get used on any given day. So all of the quadrants of who you are get employed sort of every day at a task or at a piece of work or a ministry. And that oftentimes lines up with what God wants us to do and be, right? That we get to use all of ourselves.
I really believe that. I think the my favorite vocational quote is Frederick Buechner's, that your calling or vocation is where the deep gladness of your heart meets the world's great need. And I think that, you know, searching for that intersection of vocation and avocation. And I very much, one of the things I love about Habitat is it is that sort of that full integration.
This is your producer, Easton Davis, and we'll be right back with more of Four People. This Lent, we invite you to keep a holy Lent and grow closer in your relationship with Jesus. Starting on March 9th, Bishop Wright and the Diocese of Atlanta will embark on a 5-part Lenten video series, Growing in the Wilderness. God does amazing things in the wilderness, even when the wilderness stretches on for a while. This series is based on biblical stories in the wilderness that remind us what God can teach us there and the good things that come out of these times. Each week, you can watch a short video meditation from Bishop Wright and download a reflection guide that is a companion for each video. Learn more at EpiscopalAtlanta.org. And now back to Four People.
So when the average person thinks about Habitat for Humanity, you know, the picture that pops up in our mind is our former President Jimmy Carter with a bandana around his neck. And even though he's advanced in age, he's swinging a hammer. He's doing the work. He's shoulder to shoulder with all kinds of folks. Tell us about Jimmy Carter, Habitat for Humanity, and beyond all of that. What do we need to know beyond President Carter?
So one of the great myths about Habitat, though it's usually in our favor, is that most people think President Carter both started and runs Habitat.
Right, that's right.
Actually, a man named Millard Fuller started Habitat, and a pastor named Clarence Jordan was really the, in a way, the godfather, spiritual father of Habitat, who started an interracial farm back in 1942 in southwest Georgia, in between Plains and Americus. And you can imagine how popular that was. And Clarence Jordan was really a prophetic figure, who I think is a great hero of Georgia. And the farm never worked, but in the 60s, he pulled a group of people together to pray about what might be next. And they had been bombed and boycotted and harassed for their, I think, countercultural and views and way of treating people. And it was, and Millard Fuller had come and was a part of this group. And there was a wonderful letter that came out of this week of prayer and discernment. And it's extraordinary how far ahead of its time it was. And one of the things Clarence wrote was, what the poor need is not charity, but capital, not caseworkers, but co-workers. And what the rich need is a wise, honorable, and just way of divesting themselves of their overabundance. And he had this vision that everyone had something to give and something to gain when they worked together. And so that was the beginning. And Millard, they started with some tests working with sharecropping farmers. And then Millard went off as a missionary to what was then Zaire. And did test it for 3 years as the Fund for Humanity, this idea you'd have a fund, and then came back and officially started in 76. In 84, President Carter, having left the White House and come back to Plains, had gotten involved locally with Habitat. And he was up at a UN conference and jogging in New York and saw a bunch of students working on a Habitat project in the Lower East Side. And he was heard by the press saying, we should come help these children and these students. And Millard jumped all over that. And later that year, President and Mrs. Carter rode a bus up with a whole group of volunteers, and they slept in a church basement. No one had ever seen an ex-president behave this way. In fact, there was one little Sunday school room that was set aside for the Carters, but one of the couples had given up their honeymoon to come on the trip. So the Carters gave them the room and slept out on the floor with everybody else. And they worked for a week, beginning the rehab of this five-story tenement building. And that's when the world really found out about Habitat. And that started what turned into 37 years of the Carters every year building somewhere in the world. And really, you can look back and the leadership that were that were raised up country by country and city by city to host those events ended up really building not just Habitat's brand and reputation, but engaging the growth. So he and Mrs. Carter have had an indelible mark. And he would say he's just a volunteer, but clearly he has set a standard of volunteerism in a way that that's quite extraordinary.
Two things about Habitat, well, really more than two things, but two things immediately come to mind when I think about Habitat and its mission. It's a Christian organization, and yet it's not just for Christians. And so how do you hold Jesus Christ at the center of that and yet invite all kinds of people to join you in the work?
You know, that's such a great comment. And a wise person said a long time ago, there are problems you solve and tensions you manage. And I think it's helpful to think of, you know, in our binary world where everything is all or nothing, I think this is one of those tensions we embrace, because the reality is we have two central values. One is we are trying to be as best and fallibly as we do it, a Christian mission and to demonstrate God's love. And we have another core value of inclusion and radical inclusion that we want everyone to be in. And those two, I don't think are mutually exclusive, but there occasionally are tensions. And a long time ago, one of our Habitat affiliate chapter leads used the phrase, God is our center, not our border. And I like the imagery of that, because it is our core motivation is to follow Jesus's commands to share God's love in the world. But that doesn't have to be everyone else's motivation. And the good news is that service, I think, is the healing place where people of all backgrounds and faiths can come together around their shared value and focus on what they actually hold in common versus spending so much energy on what separates them. And so I rejoice. We do interfaith builds, and it's wonderful because in the U.S. we've often done Abraham builds, where we have mosques, synagogues, and churches building together. And they're all, it's a chance for relationship. So the build becomes a vehicle for relationship. And out of our respective faiths, we can come serve a common cause. And so at our best, I think Habitat does that really beautifully, that feeling on the build site is certainly, that was my first experience of Habitat when I was in the private sector, a sense of community that is increasingly rare these days. And I think when people experience that community, it's infectious, and you want to have more of that.
I think it was Walter Brueggemann who said that if we're going to follow Jesus, I mean, really, and as maturely as we can, we're going to have to give up smallness, separation, and superiority, right? And so the way, and what I do with that is that it's because Jesus, I get to get shoulder to shoulder with people, right? So it's actually because I believe in Jesus, you know, I'm sort of driven to be beside people, not to exclude people. So in fact, being a Christian drives my commitment to diversity, right? It drives my commitment to inclusivity rather than the opposite, which I think, sadly, is the perception out there, that to say that we love Jesus and are trying to follow Jesus is driving exclusivity, when the converse is actually more true and jives more with the Gospels.
I couldn't agree more. You know, I think if the framing is you can either be Christian or inclusive, it's sort of game over. I would reject that frame, and we are inclusive because of our faith, that following Jesus compels us to reach out and love everyone, that he has a big view of who our neighbor is.
And even Jesus managed this tension, right? I mean, Jesus was hanging out with the disciples, and they came upon some folks who were doing a good work, and the disciples wanted to make sure, hey, these guys are not charter members here. Who are these guys? And basically Jesus says, hey, take it down a notch. Let them do the work. You know, if they're doing the work, I'm just fine with them. You know, this other idea you have, which I think is a radically inclusive idea that allows all kinds of people to come and join you, is the theology of the hammer, right? Say a little bit about that.
Well, it is, you know, and I think my theologian friends might be skeptical that it's really a theology, but it's a very powerful concept, which from the early days, which is out on that build site, very much like we were just talking about, suddenly all those other social and other barriers go away. And so that that act of common service is actually a vehicle for relationship and trust and service. So I think it starts with the idea that if we put that serving towel over our arm and show up and love people, we can we can take some of the pressure off ourselves and let God just intervene in the midst of that. But it starts with that idea, I think, of coming just to, with no agenda, just to serve and just to love. And if we do that well, a lot of these other issues can take care of themselves.
Yeah, I like to think of it. So I'm an ex-military guy, and I think back to some of the rhyme and reason of our serving with people from all kinds of different backgrounds and all kinds of places from around the country. There was less talk and more work. And when we actually got to talking, the talking about, you know, differences and variations, et cetera, was sort of benefited from the fact that we had worked together the day previous or all day before we got together in the evening. And I think conversations were more human, perhaps more compassionate, because we started off as co-laborers before we got to debate and conversation.
Well, it's, you know, Bill Ury, one that wrote that wonderful book, Getting to Yes, and a friend introduced us. And he had this theory, if you're going to have a tough conflict negotiation, and he does a lot of international peace work, don't sit across the table from each other, go for a walk, because then you're shoulder to shoulder, you're aiming in the same direction, you're outdoors. He said, much better. And then he said, even better, go build a house together, because that, it, just as you say, that act of working together on a common mission reminds us of our shared humanity, and as opposed to the bombarding we have every day of the other and all the ways that I think our society is reinforcing polarization.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So we, as you well know, we've all been sort of had this gut punch called COVID that has in some ways, in weird ways, it's benefited us. I mean, a lot of people are reporting that charitable donations have gone up. And so that's on the positive side of things. But on the other side of things, the embodied nature of shared work has sort of gone down and been limited, constrained. What's it been like to try to do this work in COVID?
You know, it's certainly been the biggest challenge we've ever faced, I think. Now, we've had financial challenges. And just as you say, a huge blessing is that in some ways, because COVID had such a disparate effect, it for people with knowledge work and a safe place to shelter, this was actually a financially positive time. Whereas for service workers without good housing, it's been a catastrophic time. But I do think it's been terrible for society. And this message of everyone stay home and shelter in place, and all the important restrictions from a public health perspective, have I think we paid a terrible price for that. And for Habitat specifically, it didn't stop us from building, but it did change the way we had to build. So because we really had to move towards contractors and what I would call our high skill regular volunteers, who are almost like staff, construction's actually been a safe activity all the way along. And it's something we wear masks anyway, but the group unskilled volunteering largely ground to a halt, and our chain of Habitat restores all closed for about 60 days early on. And so it's been a massive disruption, and it has somewhat slowed down construction country by country, depending on the severity of shutdowns and ability of people to get to work, et cetera. But the bigger concern for me is all the social issues that you hint at, and in a way, the ability to engage people in a relational way. And I believe COVID has also revealed and exacerbated, which is our core mission, a housing affordability crisis. So suddenly everyone wanted more space, and we have not been building enough housing, certainly in the United States, for the last 12 years since the great housing recession. And so what's happened now is without enough housing, we're seeing housing rental rates and prices accelerate far faster than cost of living or inflation. And that is driving inflation, but it's creating a disastrous environment. And internationally, it's just heartbreaking when everyone's told to shelter in place, but you don't have a safe place in which to shelter, or you live in terribly overcrowded and unsafe conditions without water and sanitation. How do you ask people to do that? Or even if you can't eat, if you aren't out working. So it has been, it's been from a human perspective, this has been a catastrophic couple of years.
You know, in the Episcopal Church and other denominations have their way of saying this. We talk about respecting the dignity of every human being. And it seems to me that's a wonderful phrase, and I believe it with all my heart, but, you know, in a very practical sense, you know, dignity, you know, includes safe shelter. safe, clean shelter. And so, you know, as I think about Habitat's work, I mean, it's dignity work, right? I mean, people get to participate in creating their own shelter. Again, there is some sweat equity there. People are involved in this. It's not simply charity. It's dignity work. Do you see it that way, or what would you add to that?
Very much so. One of our long sayings has been that no one can live in dignity until everyone lives in dignity, and that there's a sense that that's a vision of what, you know, a just and good society would look like in God's image. And so for us, very much so. And one of the reasons we think the volunteering piece is so important is because we've increasingly become economically segregated, and there's a racial component under that correlates with that. More and more people are growing up really unaware, because they may be very comfortable mixing across faith and race, but they have very little meaningful relationship with people outside their socioeconomic class. And I think this is terrible on a whole series of dimensions. But one of that is it has created an invisibility of an existing housing crisis that in some ways has only become visible because now middle class families, children can't afford housing. So now it's become visible.
Yeah. No, funny enough, I was reading an article in the New York Times this morning, and it was talking about these smaller cities. Now, there's an exodus from larger cities, which have become untenable for lots of people, to the smaller markets. But the smaller markets now are exploding at such a rate that housing affordability is going down rapidly. So in a place like Spokane, for instance, now, the average housing price has jumped 50%. In recent years, pricing out, you know, those first time home buyers, people starting off on partnerships and marriages, et cetera, you know, at that sort of very entry level, it's just untenable for them. And so if that is the case for, you know, two sort of educated working folks, how much more is that the case for other people who don't have the benefits of that?
Absolutely. And we wouldn't argue that everyone should own a home. But historically, and particularly for families of color and low-income families, owning a home over time has been the best way to create an intergenerational asset. And when we look at home ownership, there's a huge correlation in the wealth gap when we look at the families with assets and without assets. And if you have an asset, then you have access to finance. There's a whole series of positive things that can happen with that. And what we're seeing now is we're really shutting out a huge number of families from ever even having the potential to be able to purchase a home. Because when you are paying half your income on rent or more, how can you possibly save up the down payment? And then, of course, you know, these explosions in cost. Atlanta, you know, our hometown, used to be a very affordable place, which was a huge benefit of people coming. Now, relative to San Francisco, it's still affordable. But that house that we used to be able to build for $90,000 is now appraising at $225,000. And incomes have not moved in any way, shape, or form to keep up with that.
No, that's right. And of course, in Atlanta, Dr. King's home, and the home of so many good and generous folks and good and generous work over the years, over the decades, you know, we also, unfortunately, you know, have this distinction of being a place where there's such disparity. Economic disparity, housing disparity, health disparities, lots of disparities here. And obviously housing is a huge piece of that.
Absolutely. And the solutions aren't easy. One, we just have to build way more housing. I mean, there's a supply problem. And actually, we had our national advocacy conference last week, and it was virtual instead of usually it would be in D.C. And we met with 400 members of Congress. So most of the Congress. And I was really struck in the conversations I was having that finally it was starting to resonate that if we don't increase the housing supply, it's really hard to manage inflation. And in fact, so building more housing is not only drives economic growth and good jobs, it'll actually lower the inflationary pressure because you've got more housing. If you pour more money into housing assistance, which we think we should do, but you don't build more housing, that will actually drive up prices even faster. And so we need to work on the supply side. And then we also philosophically, and this is where, you know, I'll switch from preaching to meddling, people of faith have need to move to a yes in my backyard. The best model for human flourishing are mixed income, mixed use communities where people can live close to work. It's better for the environment. It's better for their families. It's better for social mobility and opportunity, as the data has overwhelmingly showed. But But we've moved in the opposite direction in the last 50 or 60 years in the way we've organized our cities. So it is, I think there is an urgency to figure out how do we build more housing in locations where people can be close to where the jobs are. And I think everyone wins, in my belief, that way. But it is, regardless of political stripe, there is the walls go up really fast in communities of opportunity when we talk about building more affordable housing. And Habitat's probably the friendliest face of affordable housing.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt about it. And I remember being, when I was being sort of onboarded to the board, I remember really being struck by the fact of the sort of brand identity piece and positive brand identity piece that Habitat for Humanity has. And so it's a trusted brand. And I'm so glad, because we need a trusted brand, a trusted face, a trusted voice organization in this space. Because I think there are people who would be willing to join forces if they got a sense of the why and the impact and all these wonderful things you've told us about here. This podcast was started to sort of reach out to the Diocese of Atlanta and then beyond, and has done that. But the average listener, as far as we know, is connected to some religious community, some congregation. What can the average congregation do to begin to sort of contribute positively to Habitat?
Well, thank you for that. And the answer, whether it's Habitat or the broader mission of housing, I think it's critical. There's an element of hospitality, you know, of welcoming the neighbor that is so central to, I think, our collective and broad faith. And it is, so there's some specific things. One, many churches have land. And one of the giant impediments is finding land where to build. So there's a possibility of actually creating social enterprise and helping create housing at a specific level. Bigger than that, I think, is will we be willing to be the people saying yes in my backyard and welcoming in housing? And it is one of my favorite stories. I don't know if you ever met Tony Campolo. He was on our board many years back, and love Tony. And he tells a wonderful story that is so compelling to me. And it was a little town in outside Philadelphia, Norris, Pennsylvania. And they were going to vote at the city council on whether to allow some supportive housing for developmentally disabled adults. And a bunch of people were really unhappy about this. And the community hall filled up and media was there. And they took a vote and unanimously voted against allowing this supportive housing to get built. And suddenly the door opened, very dramatic, and Mother Teresa walks in.
Oh, my God.
And it's like, the Mother Teresa. And she walks in, and she'd been at an event in Philadelphia and heard about this and said, I need to go. And she walks down the aisle, kneels down in front of the city council and says, please, in the name of our Lord Jesus, don't treat our brothers and sisters this way. And there's a long pause, and the cameras are rolling. And finally, one of the city council members puts his hand up. I move we revote. They vote again, unanimous vote the other way. No one in the audience says a word. And now, obviously, Mother Teresa had moral authority, and you know, she had earned the right to speak up on the streets of Calcutta, but. It is, but hey, it doesn't have to be Mother Teresa. You know, we can all add our voice and be part of that. So I think it's going to be absolutely, you know, bring your muscles and come out and build. But that's about community building, and actually as a selfish act, I find whenever I volunteer, that's more for me than my contribution, but use that engagement in the community to be a springboard into actually, you know, can we move housing policy in a direction that that really creates more equitable access for all of our towns or all of our communities? And can we use our influence, and can we look at the barriers that are stopping housing from getting built? And this is not one political party or the other. How do we make it easier and faster to build more so that we actually have enough? Because today the market is really broken. A good-hearted builder, and we're a good-hearted builder, cannot build something that is inexpensive enough for a lower, even moderate income family to afford on a reasonable percent of their income. So we've got to come up with innovative solutions and more ways to go. But I would just encourage, if you're listening and this tickles your heart a little bit, think about what is the context you're in? What's the need in your local community? And how could your congregation be a part of lowering those barriers or addressing the need and helping create more housing, whether it's with Habitat or in other ways?
Let me just say one last thing and then we'll wrap up. Boy, I tell you, your grandmother must be proud. I hope she lived long enough to see you get up every day and do this work. In you, I hear this tension, right? I hear that you're bringing your intellect to this, you're bringing your heart to this, you're bringing your hands to this, and you're familiar with all of the obstacles to all of this. So you know, a lot of us are ground down these days. You know, it's been tough, and to watch the news is to feel like for some that there's good reason to despair, right? But I hear you being very familiar with the obstacles. You sized up Goliath, and yet instill your swing in the slingshot, right? So what's the hope about, Jonathan? Where's the hope coming from? I got the Micah piece. I got the charge. Where's the hope coming from?
I think the hope comes from the relationships. And that's the part I'm most eager to be sort of looking at COVID in the rearview mirror. Because it's, you know, when I think about what charges my batteries up, it's seeing the, you know, especially the children, but the families who, when given a chance, can flourish and have impact and grow into all that God intends for them. And so for me, it's the faces of the families and communities I've had the chance to visit all around the world over the years. That's what kind of lights me up all over again, and seeing transformation happen. And I think we're all in the transformation business. And certainly the caution is it's got to start with our own internal transformation. And I think one of the greatest dangers is that we're all about transforming everything else and we don't pay enough attention to our own soul care and our own inner transformation. And that's certainly a danger for me and I think in any of us. But to me, the hope part is we know there are things that work. Now we need the will. There's nothing easy about it. I don't think God ever said it would be easy, just that it would be good. But when you see what good looks like, it reminds us that this is possible. And it's not a resource question, it's a will question. So can people of goodwill lock arms and decide that we are going to tackle these really complex issues? And it will be messy and hard and slow, but it's really urgent. And I think the not so secret beautiful part is when we get lost in serving, I think that's where real joy comes from. I know for me, the most joyful parts of my life have been when I'm all in on mission and less focused on myself and all my own challenges and issues.
Friends, this has been Jonathan Reckford, CEO of Habitat for Humanity. You can get to the website through habitat.org. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you so much for the gift of telling this wonderful story and doing this amazing work.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It is a joy and a privilege, and it's great to be with you.
Thank you. God bless everybody.